from the ice-swept tundras of Raleigh, North Carolina. Your North Carolina Reading Service now presents... Indie Week. And it's read, of course, for our blind and print-impaired listeners. Today, by John Federson. And I'm in our cozy igloo studios, buried today, of course, under at least, at the very least, 2 millimeters of snow. This issue of The Independent is dated January 23rd of 2025. And let's get started. Okay, I have fortified myself with my hunks of tofu jerky. That's what we have around here in our cold cupboard. And I'll get started with the two basic administrative political articles from this week. First, Attorney General's review is stalling St. Augustine's $70 million acre, 105-acre land lease deal with 50-plus-1 sports. This land lease deal between St. Augs and the Florida-based real estate firm is stalled pending a review by the NC Attorney General's office, according to the university. Last month, Monty Valerie, a managing partner of 50-plus-1 sports, told Indy his company had signed a 99-year lease on all 105 acres of St. Augustine's campus and planned to build a mixed-use development on 55 mostly empty acres, leaving the main campus undisturbed. According to Valerie, 50-plus-1 plans to pay SAU $70 million upfront for the land and eventually share revenue from the development with the university in a 65-35 split. The deal came along at a critical time for St. Augs. The Raleigh HBCU faced budget cuts, layoffs, tax liens, and a lawsuit brought by alumni and former trustees in 2024 and incurred millions of dollars in debt. Its accrediting body, the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools Commission on Colleges, SACSCOC, voted in December to remove SAU from its list of members for the second time in as many years, citing a laundry list of financial and governance issues. The SACSCOC appeal timeline adds a sense of urgency to the land lease deal. A $70 million check from 50-plus-1 sports could go a long way towards demonstrating that the SAU is on a path to financial sustainability and helping them regain accreditation, but only if it arrives by early February, in time for the university to present it as evidence in its appeal to the commission. Before any money can change hands, though, the Attorney General's office is legally required to review the land lease. Since SAU is a nonprofit and the lease involves all or a majority of its property, the AG's office confirmed to Indy in mid-December that it had begun the review but has declined to provide any further updates. A spokesman for SAU, DeMarcus Williams, told Indy the school board has sent 2 rounds of responses to questions from the AG's office since December but has not received a decision. According to the Department of Justice website, the review can take up to 60 days once the AG's office has all the information it needs, including the finalized contract, proof that it's legally binding, and, quote, information about SAU's debts, relevant board meeting minutes, and, quote, identification of any actual or potential conflicts of interest. As the clock ticks towards this deadline, St. Augus has taken the irregular step of calling on the university community to contact the new Attorney General, Jeff Jackson, and the new Governor, Josh Stein, and urge them to expedite the approval of this land lease. And it wrote in a press release, its approval is paramount to SAU's financial stability and long-term sustainability. Meanwhile, some SAU community members are wondering if there is a good reason the approval is taking so long. Stephen Williams, an SAU alumnus, founder of Falcons Unite and member of the Save SAU Coalition, in a conversation with Indy this week, said, does 50 plus 1 have a proof of concept? Have they built any mixed-use development like this anywhere? Valerie declined to comment on behalf of 50 plus 1 Sports. Well, next to Durham. And we've reported, Indy Week has reported on Shot Spotter and some of the controversy about that policing software. And here's a very long article now in the current issue, which kind of sums things up for us. The company behind Shot Spotter says it curbs gun violence, but some cities fear it's an empty promise. Not long after midnight, in early October of 2023, Lawrence Artis walked across an empty parking lot in one of the many strip malls that have earned Fayetteville a reputation for urban sprawl. The lot is located in one of three high gun violence areas in the city, and just 4 days earlier it had been outfitted with a gunshot detection technology, ShotSpotter. As Artis passed in front of a dimly lit storefronts, a Dollar Tree, discount streetwear shop, liquidation store, and a plasma donation center where he used to give blood, a squad car approached. Officers had received a notification of gunfire from Artis' locations. Three officers got out and detained him for a search. Artis, a 29-year-old black man, was, quote, very anxious when first stopped and handcuffed, according to the state records on the case. The officers seized a gun they found in the search, but records indicate they planned to let Artis go with a warning. A background check revealed Artis had been convicted of repeat burglary and theft, 3 years earlier. They arrested him for possession of a firearm by a felon. For reasons still unexplained in later investigations, officers missed a second gun hidden in Artis' pants pocket. That's when the encounter turned violent. Police claim that Artis, who was still handcuffed at the time, managed to grab the second gun and shoot himself in the head. He died 4 days later. It was later officially ruled a suicide. Fayetteville Police Chief Kimberly Braden has maintained the officers heard gunfire moments prior to receiving a ShotSpotter notification, and that the technology only, quote, verified what they heard. Still, the police department has not provided any evidence of the initial gunshot that alerted officers. Conflicting details about Artis' final moments have emerged in the 15 months since, but one question has remained consistent. If Fayetteville had not been using ShotSpotter, would Artis still be alive today? Last September, the Fayetteville City Council voted 6-4 to renew its contract with ShotSpotter for another year, granting $210,000 in funding for continued service. City Council members had debated whether to end the contract or renew it for 1 to 3 more years. Those who supported the 3-year renewal and voted against a 1-year contract declared the technology significantly contributed to Fayetteville's decreasing violent crime rate in 2024. One council member claimed Durham's crime rate had gone up because it dropped the tech, while Fayetteville's had decreased as a result of keeping it. Their faith in ShotSpotter, or at least the police chief's positive assessment of it, was ironclad. Councilmember Derek Thompson says, we assigned him to do a job in the city of Fayetteville. Why are we not taking his recommendations? Why are we looking outside of what our chief wants? That's where I'm confused. Councilmember Mario Benavente, who had proposed the successful motion to study ShotSpotter, criticized other members for not caring, quote, whether it works or not, or whether we're getting what we were promised. Licensed in 1996, ShotSpotter is now used in more than 180 communities across the country. The company's founder thought sensors used to detect earthquakes could also be used to locate gunfire. The technology is in 6 cities in North Carolina. Fayetteville, New Bern, Wilmington, Rocky Mount, Greenville, and Goldsboro. The company, which changed its name to Sound Thinking in 2023, is growing, with projected revenues of $100 million last year and deployment in four new cities and one university. Sound Thinking also now sells technology to recognize vehicles and license plates and to detect weapons, as well as customized versions of the gunshot application. That is for highways and college campuses. At the same time, a number of major cities have ended their contracts with the company, including Chicago, Atlanta, and Portland, Oregon. So have Durham, Winston-Salem, and Charlotte, which ends its $160,000 a year contract for the technology in 2016 after 4 years, saying, quote, the return on investment was not high enough to justify renewal. Activists and organizations like the ACLU say the technology is both ineffective and racially biased and has led to wrongful arrests and over-policing in Black and Latino communities. The company has aggressively defended itself against criticism and says its products are a public safety technology. On its website, the company has a section entitled False Claims, detailing what it calls misleading and inaccurate news coverage of ShotSpotter. ShotSpotter saves lives, said Tom Chittum, the company's vice president of analytics and forensics. He said, we know there's chronic underreporting of gunfire in urban areas even when there are victims, and ShotSpotter helps fill that gap. For months after Artis' death, activists in Fayetteville had raised concerns about the role ShotSpotter may have played. The City Council's renewal of the contract with Sound Thinking last fall brought this subject back into the fore. Community organizers bearing signs that said Justice for Lawrence Artis flooded the September meeting where the council debated the terms of the contract. They argued ShotSpotter can become part of a feedback loop that reinforces existing racial disparities in policing, increasing unnecessary and negative interactions between law enforcement and the predominantly minority communities where this technology has been deployed. An investigation by Wired in 2024 leaked ShotSpotter sensor data covering 84 metropolitan areas and 34 U.S. states or territories, and finding that 70% of residents who live in neighborhoods with sensors are Black or Latino. In Fayetteville, ShotSpotter has been deployed in 3 one-mile radius zones around Cliffdale and Riley Roads in West Fayetteville, in the Murchison Road corridor, and in the Massey Hill neighborhood. The police department has said the locations were chosen based on shots fired service calls and other gun violence metrics, and that drug and weapons crimes are higher there than the city's average. But those areas had poverty rates significantly higher than the city overall, according to a 2023 Economic and Community Development Department analysis. City View reviewed the racial demographics in areas that police said they received the most ShotSpotter alerts in the first year of operation and found 8 of the 9 locations were predominantly Black in a city that has a Black population of 41%. Sound Thinking's Chittum dismissed concerns about racial bias and said cities deploy ShotSpotter in locations with the highest historical rates of gun violence. Quote, it is well known, very clear, and indisputable that gun violence does not affect everyone in America the same way. And I think if you look at ShotSpotter deployments, it is invariably in places where it can do the most good and locate the most victims. Fayetteville Council ultimately approved the $210,000 contract for another year by this vote of 6-4, under the condition there be an independent evaluation and parameters for its success after another year. Council member Brenda McNair said at the time, I don't see where it would hurt us just to have 1 year and have another opportunity to look at it again and come back and vote a longer term at a later date. It's crucial that we hold these systems accountable. Sean McMillan, an organizer with Fayetteville Freedom for All, criticized the council for not discussing Artis' case and, quote, their responsibility to prevent the unnecessary loss of life during the debate about the technology. Braden dismissed concerns about over-policing in an interview after the vote. ShotSpotter has been a useful tool for the police department, he said, allowing law enforcement to respond faster to dispatch calls and collect useful evidence, especially at a time when there were more than 100 vacancies in the department. Artis' case, quote, proves that ShotSpotter works. The officers were across the street. They heard the gunfire. ShotSpotter verified what they heard. They go over there. They deal with Lawrence Artis. ShotSpotter started as a bit of an experiment. Physicist Robert Schauern was trying to locate earthquake epicenters in Stanford Research Institute in California when he heard gunshots in a nearby neighborhood back in 1996. He wondered if the same seismographic technology could also be used to register gunfire. With the help of two engineers, he soon founded ShotSpotter. Over the next 15 years, Schauern's team raised money, developed technology, and deployed it initially in 20 cities. In 2010, they hired Ralph Clark as the CEO. Clark helped establish the Incident Review Center, allowing more cities to adopt ShotSpotter, and took the company public in 2017. 2 years later, the company said it had approved the technology's accuracy and was serving more than 100 customers. How does it work? It places an array of acoustic sensors in a designated area. These sensors are linked to a wireless, cloud-based system that company officials say can send alerts when there are sounds of gunfire. The alerts are sent to the company's Incident Review Center, where staff assesses the alerts and dispatch them to law enforcement agencies. Officers can then respond to the alerts, where they will locate possible victims and find evidence of gun violence. SoundThinking's main claim is that 80% of all gunfire goes unreported. ShotSpotter technology, company officials argue, fills the gap. The technology captures more incidents of gunfire, which means law enforcement agencies can potentially locate gunshot victims and help put a dent in gun violence. Critics say ShotSpotter simply doesn't work. It registers shots where there is no evidence that any happened. Accuracy is the main reason that Chicago cited in its decision to discontinue in 2024. A report from Chicago's Office of the Inspector General found that evidence of gunfire was found in less than 10% of the 50,000 alerts in the city between January 2020 and May 2021. A 2024 audit from New York's comptroller found that in June of 23, 82% of ShotSpotter alerts could not be confirmed when officers arrived at the scene. The audit, however, find that ShotSpotter improved response times to possible shootings, giving potential victims a better chance at survival. Brooklyn Defenders, a public defender's office, analyzed 9 years of city data and found that the New York Police Department was only able to confirm the accuracy of ShotSpotter in about 17% of cases. Out of 75,000 ShotSpotter alerts in the 9-year period, less than 1% of them resulted in the recovery of a gun. The city still has a contract, company officials said, but declined to provide further details. The NYPD is seeking a 3-year renewal, but the city has not appeared to have acted on it. The company has fought back, pointing to research, including a report on Winston-Salem, that the technology does make a difference. Researchers from the Center for Crime, Science, and Violence Prevention at Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville produced an initial report and then updated it last year. The report said the area in which ShotSpotter was deployed saw a 24% decrease in assaults and homicides, and that the response time to these alerts is significantly quicker than those called in by residents. That company also sued Vice Media for defamation in 2021 for an investigative story that alleged police departments asked SoundThinking to alter ShotSpotter alerts. Company officials denied the allegation. A judge ultimately dismissed that lawsuit, but Vice Media and the Associated Press, which ran a piece detailing similar allegations, ran corrections. Even as some cities have ended their contracts, the company says it wants to continue to work in North Carolina. Whether that means expanding its reach into the state, the company is mum, only saying it was looking, quote, forward to working with other jurisdictions in the state to instrument the same rapid response capabilities to criminal gunfire. Chittum, who was formerly with the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, told the Assembly, that's a journal that the Indie Week subscribes to, that he was skeptical about the technology when he first joined the company in 2022, but he has since become its most public spokesman. He called criticisms of it inaccurate and misleading, and he argued that academic research, including the report on Winston-Salem's experience, actually shows the technology leads to law enforcement officers responding more quickly and that gunfire is detected at higher rates than 9/11 calls. Many people have a shallow understanding of how the technology works, he said. Even if police don't immediately find any evidence at a scene, that doesn't necessarily mean there wasn't gunfire. Quote, what we see is that when police go back during daylight hours, they use metal detectors or canines to find fired cartridge casings. Chittum didn't offer any specific data on how often law enforcement officers find gunfire evidence the next day. He noted police might not found any evidence after a 9/11 call either, and no one is demanding to eliminate that service. The company, however, could not provide much hard data on the number of arrests or convictions that have resulted from ShotSpotter alerts, or how often prosecutors in North Carolina or elsewhere have used ShotSpotter evidence to reach convictions. The company doesn't require law enforcement agencies to keep track of certain metrics that might illuminate how effective it is. Chittum acknowledged, while the company encourages law enforcement agencies to track such metrics, the company could not require it in the contracts. And he said, we don't know about that unless they report it to us. And he said, data collection is an issue for many agencies, so the company's focus is to make things easier for the customer to collect data and share it with SoundThinking. Durham and Winston-Salem were among the best customers when it came to tracking metrics, he said. That's why company officials were so stunned when both cities decided not to renew. He said Durham and Winston-Salem were exemplary customers. ShotSpotter arrived in Winston-Salem in 2021 as the city leaders, concerned about an uptick in gun violence, desperately sought solutions. Assistant Police Chief Natosha Miles told the Public Safety Committee in 2021, now more than ever, we want to get a better handle on gun violence. Miles cited the 2020 death of Jerrica McGee, whose body was found on the side of a road. People heard gunshots, she told the committee, but no one called the police. We know that if we had had a gunfire detection system in place, we would have been immediately dispatched to that location, possibly getting her life-saving measures in place and maybe even saving her life. Winston-Salem City Council voted unanimously on January 4, 2021, to approve a 3-year contract with ShotSpotter using nearly $700,000 in federal grant money to fund it. The deployment was limited to a three-square-mile area northeast of downtown that is predominantly Black and poor. At the time, Councilmember Robert Clark, chairman of the city's finance committee, wondered if the city was getting the most for its money. He pointed out the area was a mere 2% of the city. But city officials seemed pleased with ShotSpotter in the early days and even featured it in a 2022 video where a police officer talked about how it led them to a victim bleeding in a field. Without the technology, said the officer, the man would have died. After that initial 3 years, however, the technology's efficacy remained unclear. According to Winston-Salem police statistics, officers responded to almost 4,000 ShotSpotter alerts over 3 years. They found no evidence of gunfire and no witnesses 54% of the time. Between January and July in 2024, they responded to 628 ShotSpotter calls. They found no gunfire evidence in 65% of them. Winston-Salem Police Captain Michael Knight told WGHP in August that they didn't think renewing the contract was worth it. Quote, a lot of times we were going out there without a corresponding 9/11 call and we're walking around looking for a shell casing, he said. City officials point to financial reasons why they were not renewing. Quote, after conducting a cost-benefit analysis of all technology used by the WSPD and evaluating our budget, we have decided not to renew our contract with ShotSpotter. The company sent a letter to Winston-Salem officials last August asking them to reconsider. Quote, over the past 3 years, our relationship with the city has been strong, and as a result, we were surprised and disappointed to learn that WSPD intends not to renew its relationship with Sound Thinking. Came in the form of an August the 2nd media report, wrote the CEO Clark. Quote, more troubling, though, is the news report and related statements that contain inaccuracies and mischaracterizations made by media outlets regarding the positive impact our services have had in Winston-Salem. City officials never responded to the company's letter, and Annie Sims, spokeswoman for the police department, said neither Police Chief William Penn nor any other police official would be available for an interview. The city of Durham made a similar call amid tensions about how to reduce gun violence as advocates rallied for more investment in programs that address the systemic problems that can lead to criminal activity. The city council voted twice against funding ShotSpotter, but in June of 2022, the council voted 4-3 to include $200,000 in its budget for a 1-year pilot covering a 3-square-mile area of East Durham. Durham police said it would measure the pilot's success, including an independent external review conducted by the Wilson Center for Science and Justice at Duke University. The results of that study were mixed. It found Durham police received 1,400 notifications of gunfire in that pilot area over the 12-month period. 57% were ShotSpotter alerts with no corresponding 9/11 call, but only 9% of those alerts resulted in confirmation of a shooting. The report also showed ShotSpotter reduced police response times in the pilot area by an average of 1.2 minutes. Overall, the center could not definitively say whether the pilot had led to reduced gun violence. During a post-mortem at a March City Council meeting, Councilmember Javier Caballero accused Sound Thinking of, quote, shifting the goalposts in how it represented their technology, focusing on the promise of quicker response time rather than reducing gun violence overall. I will not argue the data, Cavalera said, but to change the argument around your tool so you can sell it better is dishonest and not fact-based. And Durham voted 4-2 not to renew its contract. Now, in Wilmington, SoundSpotter's presence has been much less contentious. That city first started using that technology in 2011, an early adopter, along with Rocky Mount, which also continues to use it. Wilmington City Council had not publicly discussed its contract with the company since a presentation in 2019. That meeting sparked only a brief discussion, at which the now former police chief, Ralph Evangelos, presciently noted, "We are really starting at the dawn of AI." In addition to the gunshot sensing technology, that year Wilmington became the first agency in the country to implement Missions. That's ShotSpotter's AI-driven crime forecasting tool. Missions uses historical crime data to predict when and where crimes may occur, and it generates patrol recommendations based on its forecast. After implementing Missions, the department made it a policy that each officer must follow at least 2 AI-generated patrol recommendations each shift. The spokeswoman, Brandon Shope, told the assembly, "Call volume and staffing levels can and do influence how often officers are able to perform this." ShotSpotter's acoustic sensors cover at least 6 square miles with the highest concentration of serious crime rates around downtown Wilmington, the department has previously disclosed. The department declined to address the sensor's general location or coverage radius when recently asked. Evangelos told council, "I wasn't convinced ShotSpotter was going to work, and it far exceeded our expectations." Wilmington Police renewed the 3-year contract in 2022. ShotSpotter's contract this fiscal year is for $430,000, according to a city spokesperson. The AI assignments give officers various tasks to prevent crimes, like parking their cars to perform paperwork, or taking a walk in areas where the software predicts crimes are most likely to occur next. In promotional materials, ShotSpotter says the system helps departments eliminate bias by using data over what was previously officers' instinct for where and when to patrol. Wilmington officers gushed to Ford magazine in 2021 about the capabilities, but there were some holdouts getting everyone on board. Deputy Chief Alex Sotelo said, "Most officers don't like change. They feel that nothing can tell them how to do their jobs better." Shope said the department is not able to estimate how many lives the technology has saved, but called it an invaluable tool. Quote, "The presence of this device is also a great deterrence for illegal gun crimes within city limits," he said. And said the department can't disclose much about where and how they use the technology, quote, "due to security reasons," and said they couldn't comment on other agencies' decisions to stop using it. Even after more than a year, many questions about Artis's death remain. State Bureau of Investigation completed its probe by early 2024, and Cumberland County District Attorney Billy West stated in July there would be no charges against the 3 officers. While the names of the 3 officers have been made public, the Fayetteville police have refused to state whether they are still on the job. They were initially placed on administrative leave. A spokesperson says, "For personnel reasons, we cannot release any information regarding an administrative investigation, as this would be a violation of personnel laws." In late November, the North Carolina Office of the Chief Medical Examiner released its ruling that Artis' death was a suicide. But conflicting details within the police accounts, the autopsy report, and the state medical examiner's investigation have left community activists with more questions than answers. At a Fayetteville City Council meeting in January, City staff said the city has engaged the UNC Charlotte Urban Institute to do a qualitative analysis of the shot spotter zones, which will look at underlying issues contributing to the high gun violence rate in the areas, including food and housing insecurity. The study will be used to develop strategies to reduce gun violence, which is the stated goal of ShotSpotter in the first place, as part of Fayetteville's new Office of Community Safety. The city said in a statement, the results of this analysis, including recommendations for violence reduction, will help to provide a data-driven basis for moving forward with programming recommendations. Benevente, a criminal defense attorney and strong opponent of ShotSpotter, pointed to the lack of evidence linking artists to the detected shots. In 2023, he made the motion that city council study the root causes of gun violence in ShotSpotter zones. In approving the new contract, Benevente argued that his colleagues didn't care about addressing systemic issues facing those in the ShotSpotter areas. He said in an interview, we have that study that's coming back to us before the end of the year with the prescription. But until they get it, they don't want to give up their empty calorie bag of chips on the promise of a chicken dinner until they get the chicken dinner. And they're just not making the connection that, like, well, we got to make that plate available. At a meeting of Fayetteville's Community Police Advisory Board last November, Assistant City Manager Jeffrey Yates gave more details about plans to evaluate the ShotSpotter program over the next year. Yates said the city is working with the Wilson Center at Duke, the same group that evaluated Durham's program, to put together a scope and have them take a statistical look at the ShotSpotter data. He echoed a common refrain of city officials who support ShotSpotter, that is, quote, a tool in the tool belt of public safety, even if studies in places like Durham have found inconclusive results. Yates said, it's hard to prove a negative. It's hard to measure the things that don't happen. Now, some of you know, this program is first broadcast on a Friday at NC Reading Service. After that, it becomes a podcast. Well, I've been started to include Indie Selects, what to do this week, five or six events or things to do, places to go that Indie for the week, for the coming week. And so I will read what I have this week. There's usually three or four. And I will begin with the items that occur on or after the Friday. So here we go. Tomorrow, Friday, NC State Live, Matthew Whitaker. On musicians, Matthew Whitaker's third birthday, he played Twinkle Twinkle on a toy Yamaha keyboard. But he couldn't see the keys, blind since birth. He'd heard the song and figured out how to play it. Now, this pianist, who has earned comparison to Stevie Wonder, is a rising star, a three-time Herb Alpert Young Jazz Composer Award winner. Whitaker will appear at the Stewart Theater January 24 at 7:30 p.m. That's on the NC State campus, Stewart Theater. And you can go to NC State Live and look for ticket information for that performance. That's again Friday night. And still, let's see, in Durham now, at the Durham County Main Library, Saturday afternoon at 3 p.m., Durham Main Library presents Durham at a Crossroads, the 1986 Mayoral Recall Battle. In the ultra-blue Durham of 2025, it's hard to imagine a mayor facing recall election on the basis of their solidarity with the LGBTQ community. But in 1986, against the backdrop of the decline of manufacturing economy, the city split over Mayor Whib Gully's signing of an anti-discrimination proclamation that called for equal treatment of gay and lesbian residents. Factions broke out. Some seeking to recall the mayor, others in support of the proclamation, and the community became fiercely divided. In the end, the tolerant faction won out, a turning point that gave the Bull City a post-manufacturing identity to grow into. So this will be a discussion hosted by the library and moderated by Eddie Davis and panelists Steve Shule, Mab Segrist, Mandy Carter, Joe Harvard, and Leah Wise. They look back. And this is at the Durham Main Library. Registration is required. But if you can't make it, the event will be recorded and shared virtually at a later date. Durham at a Crossroads, 3 p.m. at the Durham Main Library. Also in Durham that evening, January 25th, 7 p.m. at the Sharp 9 Gallery, the Joshua Espinoza Jazz Trio will play. And also there will be His Golden Messenger will be performing at Cat's Cradle on Saturday, January 25th. So that's two different events. And let's see. That's right. So you can visit either Cat's Cradle in Chapel Hill, the Sharp 9 Gallery in Durham for these two performances to find out about admission. Then again, at the Reynolds Industry Theater in Durham, which is Saturday the 25th and then Sunday the 26th at 2 p.m., let me get that straight, January 25th at 7:30 and January 26th at 2 in Reynolds Industry Theater, Sam Green. Let's see, Sam Green, Oscar-nominated documentarian. Sam Green invites you to put on headphones and lose yourself to sound, not just in traditional music, but in the calming purr of a cat, the satisfying whirl of skates on ice, the slightest sound that can evoke a flood of emotions. This is a documentary, 32 Sounds. It's also available to screen on the Criterion Collection, but this performance is the real deal. DJ and composer J.D. Sampson will perform the soundtrack score live at the Reynolds Industry Theater, 7:30 p.m. the 25th and 2 p.m. on January 26th. All right, I have another I'll call it a hard news article, more or less. You may recall there's been now some discussion about a proposal for the University of North Carolina's power plant. And I will get into that right now. The residents of Chapel Hill do not like the power plant, at least those who turned out to a hearing Thursday night. That's a week ago. They don't like that it burns coal and natural gas, spewing carbon dioxide and methane into the air in the heart of the town. They don't like that administrators promised to stop burning coal by 2020 and failed to meet that goal. And they definitely don't like the university's attempt to amend its air permit to allow for the burning of paper and plastic pellets. Former Town Council Mayor Maria Palmer, at a public hearing on this permit amendment, said, quote, "I don't know who the administrators are who requested this permit. Are they not concerned for their own children, or do they not live in Chapel Hill?" The university has pitched the plan as a way to slowly reduce its use of fossil fuels. As Inside Climate News reported before the hearing, burning the pellets would reduce greenhouse gases from the university's physical plant, but would increase harmful levels of nitrogen oxides, lead, carbon monoxide, and volatile organic compounds. The hearing showed a stark contrast between the politics of the state's flagship university and those of the town it calls home. Palmer was one of about 50 people who showed up on a Thursday night to speak against the permit amendment. No one spoke in favor of it. The entire hearing, which was a who's who of local politics and activism, had a very Chapel Hill feel to it, writes this columnist. The speakers, a mix of students, professionals, and retired people, were all ridiculously educated, many beginning their speeches with an extensive list of degrees and credentials, and staunchly progressive, many arguing not just the permit should be denied, but that the plant should be entirely shut down. Town Council member and former EPA employee Melissa McCulloch, speaking on her own behalf, pointed out the history of the site. Quote, "This is an old problem. The surrounding neighborhoods have had to breathe the pollution from this plant since decades before there were even pollution laws. This is an environmental justice issue for the historically black neighborhoods where the people who built and served our university have lived for generations." She also compared the upcoming permit decision to decision points along the way in a years-long struggle to redevelop a 10-acre site near Bolin Creek, contaminated with coal ash. Quote, "We already know that big problems are created when decisions are knowingly made in ignorance of how bad the problem could be." The North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality's Division of Air Quality will accept public comment through January 23rd. Well, that's just closed. After that, the officer who presided over the hearing will write a report and make a recommendation to the Director of Air Quality, who will make the final decision. After the hearing, Sean Taylor, a public information officer, told Indy public comments often inform the division's final decision. Quote, "We can make changes to the draft that we put out and perhaps issue a permit that looks different than what we were proposing. Every time, pretty much, that we go through a public process, we end up strengthening the permit as a result." Some officials, though, are already looking towards a future without the power plant. State Senator Greg Meyer, who gave an introduction at the beginning of that meeting, teased the Co-Gen Transformation Project, which would make use of the plant's train line that runs through Chapel Hill and Carrboro. Meyer said, "How do we transform that rail line into an opportunity for non-automotive transportation, for connection to new housing opportunities, to economic development opportunities?" asked Meyer. Next day, fairly long article I've been looking forward to being able to read to you for a few weeks now. This one's about the Stanford L. Warren Library in Durham. 799 books. Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon is set in Michigan but begins with a reference to Durham. Quote, "The North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance agent promised to fly from Mercy to the other side of Lake Superior at 3 o'clock. You can find that oft-banned novel on the shelves of the Stanford L. Warren Library, a beloved branch in Durham's Hayti neighborhood that reopened this past December after a 3-year renovation. It's a library that contains many books you are unlikely to find elsewhere. Designed in 1940 by local architect Robert Markley, the building is a neoclassical jewel that's just had its shine dull over the years. Its closure for water damage in 2021 was supposed to be temporary. Upon meeting with community members for visioning sessions, however, the county allocated an additional $2 million to the library for more intensive renovations. The investment looks to have paid off. Airy new shelving, modern amenities, and structural reinforcement give the space a newly polished feel. But while the branch may have a fresher feel, its legacy is still at the fore. And like many institutions, its history doubles as the story of the community around it. Hayti, Black Wall Street, Durham, and beyond. Stanford L. Warren traces its origins to Dr. Aaron McDuffie Moore, one of North Carolina's Mutual Life Insurance Company's 7 founders. That company was founded in 1898. 15 years later, in 1913, Moore donated 799 books to the basement of the White Rock Baptist Church. At the time, although black Durhamites paid county taxes, they had no access to the public libraries that their taxes helped fund. Moore's makeshift library changed this. Today, those books, rare volumes on African American culture and history, comprise the Selina Warren Wheeler Special Collection. The collection has evolved and seen a lot over 110-plus years, multiple moves, including to its current Regal Fayetteville Street location. Both world wars, urban renewal, and the destruction of Haiti. The civil rights movement integrated into the country library system, county library system, that must be. More wars, the liquidation of NC Mutual, generations and generations of patrons. The historic collection is one of the library's distinguishing features and today helms a desk with a crisp-looking typewriter. Details that give the space a distinct persona. Larry Daniels, the branch manager at Stanford Warren, says, "The great thing about our library system is it has its own uniqueness. North Regional is a rural library, and it has a uniqueness to it as well. You'll see all the trees, the forestry. With this one, when you walk in, it feels like a church. We wanted to keep the historical significance of this library intact." Daniels, 39, is no stranger to Stanford Warren. He grew up in Haiti, a few streets from the library. Tall and energetic, Daniels loved basketball as a kid and wanted to be a sports journalist, but after interning in a Winston-Salem newsroom full of empty cubicles, decided librarianship was the more promising path. He's now been working at Durham Public Libraries for 8 years. Journalism or librarianship, what he really loves, he emphasizes, is storytelling. Quote, "When you come in the library and see books, it encourages people like, hey, I can write a book too." The library's upgrade includes a 3D printer, hall space for a community art gallery, and a small room for podcasting, places where people can experiment with storytelling. Daniels continues, "Now, there are different forms of storytelling. You can do it through music, through podcasts. What we're interested in is allowing people to tell that story." It makes sense that Toni Morrison's Insurance Man, searching for sovereignty and ascension in Song of Solomon, would be connected to Durham, a city that was for so long a wellspring of black self-determination. NC Mutual Life Insurance anchored that autonomy. This was expressed not just through the company's success. It was the world's largest black-owned and operated business for years, but by its investment in institutions for the black community, including the library, Lincoln Hospital, Mechanics and Farmers Bank, all located in or near Haiti. In 1916, Moore and his colleague, John Merrick, moved the church basement books to a more formalized service location on Fayetteville Street, the second library in the state available to black North Carolinians. Haiti's Durham's Colored Library, as the space was called, received some funding from the city and county. It was the surrounding community, though, that truly kept the doors open. See Eileen Watts Welch. Moore's great-granddaughter is on the board of the Durham Colored Library, which has evolved into a nonprofit. She describes Haiti as a magnet, drawing people in who wanted a better life. Like Daniels, she grew up in the neighborhood. Watts Welsh says the levels of commitment in the families for the education of the children was very strong among the residents of Haiti. Over the last next two decades, the library, largely thanks to its pioneering first librarian, Hattie B. Wooten, outgrew its small space. A $40,000 loan from NC Mutual, alongside donations from community members, notably library namesake Stanford L. Warren, whose daughter, Selena Warren Wheeler, became library director in 1934, was enough for a new building. In January of 1940, Stanford Warren officially opened. From the beginning, the space was more about than just books. It hosted regular community meetings and talks featuring prominent intellectuals like John Hope Franklin, Horace Mann Bond, and Polly Murray, who grew up visiting Stanford Warren as a child. It expanded outreach operating a bookmobile that traveled to rural parts of the county. Between 1954 and 61, it opened three branches in Durham's black communities, one of which, the Bragtown branch, operates today. In 1966, these black libraries merged into the county system. But as the library saw steady engagement, the neighborhood around it was beginning to suffer. As manufacturing and tobacco dropped off in the post-war years, the city council began to see Haiti neighborhood as an obstacle to city growth. The years-long construction of North Carolina Highway 147, completed in 1970, tore up the neighborhood, displaced thousands of families, and drew a crevasse between downtown and Haiti. Residents were never compensated for the loss of homes and businesses, and the neighborhood never fully recovered. A structural inequity reflected today in Haiti's high rates of poverty and eviction. Watts Welch says many of that generation saw their world destroyed by the demolition that occurred in 1967. This was my junior year at Spelman. I remember that spring break coming home and seeing all of the cranes up in the air. These demolitions all came under the federal umbrella of urban renewal, though Watts Welch has another name for the program, urban removal. A lot of what I knew growing up is no longer there, and that was systemic, she says. All of the planning had to do with taking properties where people were underserved and not able to defend themselves. It took away my grandparents' house, my great-grandparents' house. It took away my great-grandparents' church. It's significant, then, that the Stanford Warren branch remained standing, as the institutions around it have disappeared, all alongside the community buildings demolished decades ago. NC Mutual Life was liquidated in 2022. Well, folks, I can hear the scratching of our sled dogs outside the igloo telling me it's time to stop this broadcast because they want their food. So John Feddersen will have to say farewell now from the North Carolina Reading Service, which offers this program Indie Week as a podcast beginning on Friday. And hopefully I'll be here next week with another issue of the Independent Indie Week. Thanks for listening, everybody. This is the North Carolina Reading Service.